Cashing in on content marketing. I'm Amanda Milligan, the marketing director at Fractal, and every week on the show, I interview marketing experts about the ways to know the value of your work and get buy-in for your strategies. This week, we're chatting about search journeys and how to build your content strategy around them. Joining me for this conversation is the brilliant director of SEO at Shopify, Kevin Indig. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thanks, Amanda. It's great to be on.
Yes, I'm very excited to chat with you. You have a ton of really relevant experience. I think we could have several episodes probably, but let's focus on, I really like the way that you've kind of framed search journeys, but to lead into this conversation, what I want to know from you is, what do you think are common misconceptions about the customer journey overall? Like, what do you hear that maybe you don't entirely agree with?
My biggest pet peeve with customer journeys and buyer journeys, which I'm generally a big fan of, is this idea of a linear journey, right? I think we often have and promote this concept that everything just happens in one fell swoop, right? Like, I search for something and I get to this website and I just click through this website and then I immediately buy. And that might happen in some cases, but in most cases, the journey is very noisy. There are a lot of small little interactions happening. And it might even happen on different devices. You know, Google, probably a couple of years ago, came out with this idea of micro moments. And they wrote about this on their really good market research blog called Think with Google. And they showed that some users, when they were planning a trip, had hundreds of micro interactions with different websites along their journey. Wow. And it was over a longer span of time. And that is hard for us to decode and reverse engineer as marketers. We don't, most of the time, 99% of the times, we don't have the tools and data to really paint a full picture of the journey. So it's often much more conceptual. It's still helpful, but you have to understand the context and limitations and not kind of put it on this pedestal to say, hey, I know exactly what the journey for everybody looks like. It's much more complicated than that.
Yeah. So is this kind of the impetus for you of coming up with this kind of concept of search journeys in particular? Or how did you go about, when you recognize this problem, coming up with a solution?
It's a good question. And my thinking has really changed over the last couple of years. I started on the agency side, was consulting a lot of companies, and then I eventually went in-house, and there I had different touch points with content and different companies. You know, Atlassian was a certain gave me a certain way to look at content, and then G2 a very different way, and now at Shopify it's slightly different once again. And so there were a couple of realizations that I had over the years. One of them is the non-linearity of buyer journeys. The other one is that there's still, you know, we should still aim to keep users on our site as much as possible for various reasons. One of them is that the landscape has become very competitive. You know, the barrier to entry of content creation is lower than ever before. There's more content than ever before. And at the same time, most of the content is not visible at all. It has really become a winner takes it all game, where basically, you know, you have 10 winners, maybe 10, you know, regarding the first 10 results on Google, and you have a million of losers, right? Most content gets no links, gets no visitors, gets no social shares. And so competition is getting harder, but we also see quote unquote competition from Google, where Google gives more answers right in the search results. And that means that fewer people click through to websites. And all of that led me to learn that we need to quote unquote maximize every click that we get or make the most out of that. And search journeys to me are a way to facilitate that, because the thought behind a search journey is, even though we cannot perfectly replicate every buyer journey, we can still aim to anticipate the next step that a user would take after they landed on a article or piece of content. And by doubling down on that, and there are a couple of ways to explore what that could look like, we maximize the chance of keeping people on our site and maximize that most of that buyer journey happens on our website. That's kind of the whole idea to this.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's talk about keyword research then, because I think I've seen you kind of mention that it's not always in its straightforward old school version, the best thing to use for this kind of a philosophy. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, the classic approach to keyword research is often that we have some sort of a seed list or a couple of ideas or a couple of keywords we want to start with. We run them through a couple of tools, and then out comes a long list of variations and related keywords. And that's an interesting start, but it is very limited, right? And then we often sort that by search volume and say, okay, everything that's at the top is what we should, you know, tackle first. And it's a very narrow lens to view the SEO world. And so instead, what you really want to ask yourself is, what are all the different steps entailed in that search journey? What are people really trying to get to, right? So I started, for example, I wrote this article and I mentioned this example of starting a business, right? That could be a keyword. And there are many different steps involved for people to learn how to start a business and eventually sign up for a product like Shopify or anything else really that helps you start a business out there, right? It's not enough to just like look at all the related keywords or ways to phrase this question and create content around it. You really want to understand, okay, what are all the different steps that people go through, from business ideas to the legal side to creating a website and whatnot. So there are many different steps, and there are a couple of ways that we can improve our keyword research process. One of them is to just simply look at the related searches at the bottom of the search results on Google. It's very simple but elegant, because Google tries the same thing as us. By looking at the whole search results page, we can actually get a good idea of how Google tries to serve the user journey, because it's also their interest that users stay in the search results so they can see more ads, click more ads, and Google makes more money. Obviously, it's not as black and white, but generally we can, I think, agree on that Google tries to keep people in the search results, or tries to at least keep them on Google, right? Like, one of the worst things for Google to happen is that people go to Amazon or go to another site where they then convert. And so related searches are a great way to figure out what people might take as a next step. People also ask boxes in the search results are another great step to see questions. And then, you know, there's this whole kind of spiel around what I call SERP features, which are all the elements that Google uses to augment the search results, like a people also ask box, like a Google Maps integration, image carousel, all these things. And so by looking at all the different search features that Google shows, we can get an understanding for what all the different paths are that users might take. Another example is Google image search, where if you search for a relatively, like a not too long of a search query, Google will ask you, oh, did you mean this in the context of this or in the context of that? And so it's the challenge that we're facing is that we don't have the tools to combine all of that. But by simply doing the work and looking at the search results, we can learn a lot more about what a search journey might look like.
So once you have this list of, and you've mentioned, I might be misspeaking, but something along the lines of queries or challenges equal questions, which equals like a great impetus for content, right? That's kind of the framework for that. When you have this list of questions, if you've done kind of everything you're discussing, how do you decide how many pieces of content you're creating, you know, especially if they're similar? Like, what is that process like for you?
Yeah, it's such a good question, you know, like, and I think there's no perfect answer. I think it really depends on the context. I think we can also learn a little bit about what performs well and what ranks well. So one thing that I really enjoy, or that I can really suggest doing, is that when you have the list of different queries you want to target to cover this search journey, throw them into a keyword rank tracker that shows you how many of those keywords a single piece of content ranks for. So there are a couple of tools that will do this for you, and that will give you an idea of whether you can tackle all of these keywords with one piece of content, or whether you need to split it up. And you obviously you want to apply a little bit of logic and common sense, right? It's hard to say, okay, this is an exact way to split up content. Sometimes, you know, a huge piece of long form content does it. Sometimes you can really chop it up across different chapters or different articles. I've seen both work. And so I think it depends a little bit on the cognitive load, how complex is the topic, how many steps in that buyer journey or user journey do you anticipate people will take?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's always a really tough one to kind of walk through because I know it depends, and that's the classic marketing problem. So I want to ask you about something relevant but slightly different, which is audience personas, because I think I saw on Twitter there was kind of like a little debate going on about the value of audience personas. So I'd love to hear your perspective on that, how it does or does not fit in, and kind of how you approach it with keyword research.
You know, I've been a long time advocate of personas because I love the idea of audience research and having a profile of who your target audience is. And I still think that is valuable. If I think critically, though, over the last couple of years, how often I actually made a choice because of a persona, if I'm being honest, it's not a lot, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think the work to come up with a persona is valuable. I think the persona itself in SEO probably is not that valuable, because what I find much more valuable is a jobs to be done framework. What are people actually trying to achieve? And that makes it much more agnostic to who is actually searching, because at the end of the day, whenever, like, most people, when they search something, they'll probably want the same thing. And it doesn't matter if they're, you know, if they have a certain age, or if what their gender is, or, you know, what their preferences are. Search is very indicative because it's an intent-based concept, you know. Other than social media, for example, which is much more behavior-driven, SEO and organic search is all about intent. What are people trying to achieve? How do they phrase their query? And that probably won't vary much from one persona to the other. Now, there might be some edge cases where different demographics have different needs, right? So if you search for an insurance and you're 7 years old, it's obviously a different situation than when you're 18 years old, granted. However, I would still suggest that the jobs to be done framework can cover this. By the way, it's a framework created by Clayton Christensen, one of the most famous economists, Harvard professor, died a couple of years ago, but he was also the inventor of the disruption theory, super smart guy. And so it's a modern idea that is much more agnostic and less dependent on who people really are, and leans much heavier on what they're trying to accomplish. It's a much more problem-driven framework. And so I think, you know, it's something that I changed my mind about, where I used to put personas on this pedestal, but when I'm honest with myself, when have I ever made a different choice because I realized that, you know, I'm targeting a specific persona? Probably never.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think even for the example, like you mentioned with insurance, you would think that might come up in the keyword research anyway, right? Like the different kind of, those are very specific questions that would hopefully arise if you do the research that really, like you're indicating, and that the personas are necessary for that distinction. So that's an interesting example. You mentioned social media. I saw a quote in one of your posts that I really love, and I want to see if you still agree with it. And it's, people use search engines to solve problems and social networks to talk about them. Do you still think that's true? And if so, how do you kind of use that in your strategy?
You really did your homework, Amanda. I'm impressed. Very impressed. I still hold on to that opinion. Excuse me. I still think that's true. And I think it's something that we as SEOs often miss. I think as SEOs, we tend to have a very strong lens on search. But as I mentioned, search is very intent-driven, social media is very behavior-driven. And so these two things are intertwined, right? They go hand in hand with each other. So if you go to a social network like a Reddit, for example, or Twitter, and you look for a Twitter hashtag and how people talk about certain things, you might learn a lot about, you know, something that you might have missed if you only looked through the Google lens or the keyword research lens, right? So I think as SEOs, we would do ourselves a big service if we were to use several sources to inform our keyword strategy and our site strategy as a whole. You know, there's so many things out there that you can learn when you look at social networks. So yeah, I still do think that people talk a lot about the things that they experience and how they experience them. And that can be an indicator of something that will turn into search volume over time. So you might be ahead of your competition if you pick up on a topic that's heavily discussed on social networks, but doesn't yet show up in the search volume when you do keyword research.
That's what I was going to say. What do you say to people who would do that kind of research and be like, well, there's only, you know, zero volume. What's the point of doing something like this?
Yeah, I have my beef with search volume, you know. it's kind of a blessing and a curve because SEO is unique in the sense that, you know, and you probably, okay, let's say search is unique in the sense we probably have to take paid into account as well. But in search, we have the unique opportunity that we actually have a different way to size a market. In every other discipline, whether it's product development or it's other marketing disciplines, you mostly size a market with other means that are much less accurate, right? The idea of search volume and Google giving that data is actually pretty mind-blowing. At the same time, it's a very flawed metric. It was primarily created for ads. It's averaged out over the year. It doesn't really take seasonality into account unless you see search for seasonality in the data. You don't have search volume from Google Keyword Planner for all the different keywords. So what often happens is when you rank for a keyword, especially on page one, you'll see there's a huge divergence, a huge gap between what Google indicates as in their official search volume and how many impressions you get. So we have to use search volume in the right context, acknowledge its limitations. And again, I think there are a lot of opportunities to enrich that with other sources of data, whether it's, you know, searches on YouTube or searches on Amazon or the popularity of certain hashtags or maybe even the responses to a thread on Reddit. I think that we can be much more creative about that.
Yeah, I love some of those examples of sources of finding ideas rather than just some of the straightforward things we all rely on. So I want to go back a little bit to what we were discussing earlier and coming up with this list of questions. And, you know, we can't entirely rely on search volume, like you're saying. So how do you prioritize? To me, this is one of the hardest parts of the job in general is prioritization. So when you have this list, is there a certain part of the customer, you know, search journey you're starting at? Are you looking for gaps? Like what is your approach?
I'd probably differentiate between whether I'm starting completely from scratch or whether I already have some data.
Yeah.
Reality is in most cases, you already can look at some conversion data. You have some idea of where the biggest opportunities are. And so doubling down on opportunity sizing and understanding what adjacent topics might be to those that already perform well, that might be a logical step. I think you can also look at competitors in many cases and see what works for them. Of course, you don't have access to the data, so you always have to take it with a grain of salt, but mm-hmm. it's a valid data point on top of things. However, when you're starting completely from scratch, right? So you're a company that has a product on the market that's going well, and now the company thinks about how to grow and identify that SEO is one channel that might work out. You did start by assessing a couple of key topics that are important for the company, and then you do a research. You pull search volume, look at social networks, you know, you do some of the same things that we talked about, and then you have a general understanding of the popularity of a topic. Then I think, you know, if you start completely from scratch, it might make sense to take a very kind of shallow perspective and just get something out there that will get traction. Then you want to, as a second step, you want to assess how much impact did that actually have on the business, right? At the end of the day, we must never lose sight of the end goal, which is drive more business, anything that we do. And that's where I take a very growth perspective or growthy perspective, I guess, is that it has to lead to something, you know, if it just looks good or if there's, you know, if it's just cool or fun to do, that's not enough reason to invest. So if you start from scratch and you launch something to the best of your understanding and to, you know, the best opportunity size you can come up with, then the next step is to critically assess how much did that actually bring, right? So starting from scratch always has a bit of a leap of faith in it. And I think you can minimize risk by taking multiple sources of popularity into account.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you mentioned impact on the business. This is a big question. We're talking about how do you measure success, right? So I want to know specifically in the context of search journeys, how do you get a sense that you're right about that journey? You know, are you looking to see if someone clicks on one article and then they go to the next and, you know, hope that that's working? Or what is that process for you?
It's actually not far off. You know, I think we have the technology to really measure what the next steps are for people. Of course, at an aggregate, right? You need some traffic to monitor that. But simply by tagging, for example, the related post at the bottom of an article, or if you have a kind of next post lined up, just tracking how many people actually click on that. Heat map tracking is another one. Session recordings, right? All of these things can really help you to understand, are people getting what they need out of this piece of content? Are they dropping off somewhere? And if they have several pages per session, what is the most likely next page? And then you can refine that and iterate on that. And I think it's something that, I think there's something that is often ignored, but there's a lot happening at the end of the article, right? And you basically want to answer the question, what's the next step from here? What are people supposed to do? And oftentimes we fall into the trap of just simply placing a CTA at the end of the article when that's, you know, when people might not be ready to convert yet. So I think you might have much higher chances for success if instead of a CTA, you might place like the next article that makes sense for them to read. And so tracking all of that in an aggregate, I think can really pay off. There are some differences between the types of sites too, of course. The model that I explained basically works really well for a blog or for a more SaaS-like company. I think if we're talking about marketplaces and e-commerce sites, that can look slightly different, but not completely different, right? It's the same idea, just transplanted into user-generated content or an inventory of products. But you can still measure what's the next step that people take. If they don't, even for an e-commerce site, you know, if they don't buy the product, if they don't convert right away, what do they do next? Do they drop off? Do they search for more information? And let that inform your content strategy, right? So I think as another principle or another situation where I think we're often missing the mark, I think as SEOs, we often don't think enough about really expanding on the content that we have and answering all the questions that people might have. And so we're just thinking about the next topic, the next article. So there was a lot of rambling, I think we can measure quite a lot. And I think we often don't invest enough time into thinking about how do we measure the success of a piece of content. And it doesn't always have to be a hard sale. It can also just be the next step in the buyer journey, which would then be reading another piece of content. And we have, it's relatively simple to see how many pages per visit users take when they come to a certain piece of content.
Yeah. So related to this, we're talking about measuring the value, is getting buy-in for strategies like this. And it's tricky because there is so much data you can be pulling about each individual piece, and you know, it can get overwhelming. So what do you recommend to folks who are like, yeah, I get the value of this, I need to communicate to someone higher up than me who doesn't quite understand? What is your strategy for that?
I think there are two to three different keys to getting buy-in from executives for launching such a strategy. I think the first one is that your math has to be solid, right? You have to paint a picture built on logic of how you arrive to the opportunity size that you have, right? Opportunity sizing, I think, is something we don't talk about a lot in SEO and content marketing, but that is incredibly important to get stuff done. And so, that whole math has to be right. It can start with something like search volume, hashtag popularity, whatever you take into account, and then it has to end with business impact, right? I mentioned that a couple of times, super important to get that right. There has to be a dollar amount in your equation. And if the math is perfect or not, that's not the point. There's rarely perfect math in business, but there has to be some math. The second thing is narrative. It's incredible how often humans make decisions based on emotion instead of rationale. We think we make very rational decisions. Reality is most of our decisions are very emotional. And so to address that and embrace that, a solid narrative is very, very important. And I'm a big fan of written narratives, of documents that tell a story, you know, like what does our path to success look like? And if you feed that with solid math, I think you are 80% of the way there, right? And then sure, there might be some other things that you can do on top, like getting buy-in from several people. It certainly helps to have some advocates of your project or campaign across the company. You know, if you say, hey, this and that person already gave their buy-in or they're on board, that obviously comes, you know, with a different baseline of trust and increases the chance of buy-in. But I would say narrative and math are the most powerful weapons you have.
Yeah, I love that combination. And how long, this is the other thing we talk about all the time, is the length of time to see results for something like this. So when you're building out, not just even content, but specifically with this mindset of some of these things aren't converting, they're literally leading you somewhere else. I know you need a certain amount of traffic to even get a sense of if that's working, but when does it make sense to check in on that? Like, how often do you go to the data to see, okay, this is on the right track or it's not?
Yeah, that's the key question, right? I think there's no perfect answer. It might depend on your brand strength and your link authority as well. You know, if you have a very robust link profile, you can rank for things very quickly. I think, you know, I see that at Shopify all the time. We're very lucky to have a very strong brand. And so when we write an article, we can rank in the top five the next week, wow. Sometimes within days, can go really, really fast. And it also depends a little bit on what pieces of content, what topics, better said, Google deems you to be the most relevant in, right? So if Shopify writes about e-commerce, obviously big authority in that space, we write about something like, I have to think about something, I don't know, medical or so, which probably doesn't make a lot of sense, then we might rank much, much slower, maybe not even in the top 10. So this idea of not just authority, but also trustworthiness is something that I've been writing a lot about that I think is really, really important and key in SEO lately, because Google is putting a lot of effort and really doubles down on thinking, is this result a trustworthy result for the question that people have? And so, you know, I think generally for young companies, you can see time ranges of up to 3 months to see results. For very established companies, it can happen within a week or two. And then, of course, everybody else kind of falls in between there. And there is a component of topical relevancy or how established of an authority are you in that vertical as well.
Yeah, I know we're running out of time, but I want to follow up on that very quickly because I saw that post and it's really great. And what do you think if somebody has that list of questions and that marketer personally is like, I know this makes sense for us as a company to answer, but I'm not the right person to answer it. Is the right solution to find somebody internally who's an expert, to hire an expert freelancer? Like, what is probably the best route there?
If you have somebody internally, I think that's a great idea. However, to take a step back, I do think, and I have seen that the idea of an established profile of a writer and established expertise for a certain content is becoming more important for organic search. And Google has this EAT concept, expertise, authority, or authoritativeness and trustworthiness, where they try with many different things to come to a set of results that, you know, displays these three factors. And there are some things that we know have an impact, and other things that we make assumptions around. Basically, it seems that backlinks still have a huge impact on this idea of EAT. But at grand scale, we can say that it's more important over time for Google to display trustworthy results. There was a important moment in 2016, by the way, which doesn't accidentally coincide with the election of Donald Trump and this rise in idea of fake news and blockchain technology as well, where Google was heavily criticized for very misleading results about the Holocaust, which set up this huge chain of events where they doubled down on trustworthiness. And so I think today it's much more important to have experts writing content than maybe 5 years ago. And if you have internal experts who can write content, we're willing to do that even better. However, it might also make sense to hire somebody externally, because reality is most of the time, you know, in-house people, especially if they're not close to marketing, have very little time or are not that willing to create content. So hiring experts, I think, is absolutely valid. I do think that's a growing market over time. I think there will be marketplaces where you can hire more experts with a certain background. And I think just even with like taken, you know, like forget about SEO and content marketing, everything else, I think just from a user perspective, that's also what I would want to read or who I would want to read from.
Yeah, it makes total sense. We have covered so much in half an hour. I love it. The last question I ask everybody, Kevin, is knowing the objective of the show is to help content folks, who would you recommend to be guests on future episodes?
Yes. I think you should speak to Aaron Orendorf if you haven't yet.
I haven't.
He's a fantastic marketer, used to work at Shopify as well. Fantastic copywriter. And he currently works at Common Thread Collective, and at like a very, very e-commerce focused agency. And he has a lot of good things to say. I think he would be an interesting guest.
Awesome. Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show and sharing your wisdom. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. And thanks for doing the homework. I appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. If you've listened to this and want even more tips, sign up for our podcast newsletter by going to the podcast page on the Fractal website. And if you've learned anything from this show, we'd love it if you'd subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave a review. Finally, if you have feedback, suggestions, ideas, favorite summer beers, or anything you'd like to share with me, shoot me an email at amanda@frac.tl. I'm a shameless extrovert who would love to hear from you. Thank you to Sean Kelly for podcast music and editing, and to Joao Pereira for logo design. And thank you, dear listener. I hope you'll join us next time.